Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the first weekday when the U.S. Senate has President Biden's Build Back Better bill to consider as not just a concept to be debated now, but an actual piece of legislation passed by the House of Representatives. In case you missed it, they passed it Friday morning. Since we can assume no Republican support, Senators Manchin and Sinema's defining moments are really upon them and upon the country now. So which version of Build Back Better will they embrace? The one that the other 270 Democrats in Congress have all embraced? Or this one that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy articulated in his eight-hour, all-night floor speech before the vote?
Every page of all this new Washington spending will be paid for or borrowed from you, the American hardworking taxpayer. Every page of this new Washington spending supports more waste, more fraud, more abuse, and more corruption. And every page of this new Washington spending shows just how irresponsible and out of touch the Democrats are to the challenges that America faces today.
Kevin McCarthy, from his instantly infamous all-nighter, which included all kinds of ways to extend his time, including his conservative politics origin story.
I talk about what made me a Republican. I was in the sixth grade. I turn on the TV. I watch Jimmy Carter have a sweater on and tell me to turn the heater down, that the best days were behind us.
Well, Carter never said the best days were behind us, but he did want Americans to conserve energy and cut down on using fossil fuels. Maybe McCarthy threw in that piece of trivia to cater specifically to Manchin and his coal above all else politics. Or maybe he was just riffing. I don't know. But the other option for Manchin and Sinema, the Joe Biden version of the bill, his press secretary Jen Psaki reacted on Friday to Kevin McCarthy's marathon.
In 8.5 hours, what he did not talk about was cutting the cost of childcare, cutting the cost of elder care, what we were going to do around the country to bring more women into the workforce, to protect our climate, and that for generations to come. That, in our view, tells you all you need to know about Kevin McCarthy's agenda and what he supports.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Let's start there with Washington Post congressional correspondent Mariana Sotomayor. She mostly covers the House leadership of both parties. Mariana, thanks for starting your Thanksgiving week with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did Kevin McCarthy pull that all-nighter in the first place? You cannot kill a bill in the House with a filibuster like you can in the Senate. And he knew it would pass as soon as he went to the bathroom. Why did he do it?
Well, you know, I actually had to stay the entire 8.5 hours.
No, you
there.
Did?
So
really?
Much, I did, yes. I think I went to bed at 6 a.m. Friday morning. So very much watched the whole thing from the House chamber. And you're correct. If he sat down, if he took a pause that was way too long, if, of course, he left the chamber, then he would, of course, no longer be able to delay consideration of the bill. And that is exactly what he was trying to do. There were two motives. He really wanted to show his Republican conference that he was going to do everything possible to delay consideration of the bill. It wouldn't mean that, you know, the bill would never pass. We saw that happen Friday morning. But he does have to prove, especially to the fierce Trump allies within his conference, that he's going to do everything possible to stop Democrats from, as he puts it, you know, passing this socialist government spending bill. The other point, of course, is that he wanted to personally beat a Pelosi record. Pelosi in 2018 spoke for 8 hours and 7 minutes to try and stall Republicans' push to try and undo a lot of immigration reforms. And leadership is offered that ability. It's called Magic Minutes. It is at a time when members can only debate for 1 minute, and it is right around, like right before you can actually start to hold several votes. But leaders are afforded the time to talk for as long as they want, basically. It's usually 10 minutes, 15 minutes, but you see, like some people say, stunts like this to try and delay the vote. So he really wanted to make sure he could actually pass Pelosi's record, which he did by at least half an hour.
I saw that the Post, your paper, The Washington Post, published a video montage of what they labeled something like the weirdest moments from the 8 hours, and included that Jimmy Carter anecdote that I played. Do you know why your video editors, or maybe you, if you were the one covering it overnight, assigned to that, maybe you picked it. Why was that included?
Yeah, you know, I was not, but, it, you know, when you have these speeches that are 8+ hours, you know, Ted Cruz, the infamous filibuster from years ago that people remember him just reading Green Eggs and Ham, and that went for even longer than 8 hours. You know, you kind of run out of things to say. So there are different compilations out there of what McCarthy talked about. He brought up Jimmy Carter an astounding amount of times. Even I was surprised by it. Yeah, and he also, you know, some people took away or remember the fact that he talked about small carrots versus regular sized carrots, because you just, you know, you just kind of start vamping at some point. And I wouldn't say you lose your train of thought, but you're trying to connect your points, especially that late of the night. I mean, my brain was kind of turning off. I can't really imagine talking for 8.5 hours through the middle of the night. Who knows what we would say?
I saw that moment where he said there's no such thing as baby carrots. There are only regular carrots cut up into small pieces. Is that like baby carrots are a liberal she-she thing? Was he actually trying to make a point like that?
I believe when he said it, he was talking about agriculture and farming and just mentioned it as an aside. I don't necessarily remember if he was hitting the Democrats on carrots in particular.
But on the Jimmy Carter sweaters thing, was there a global warming hoax? Hello, Joe Manchin, you might as well just switch parties. Why don't you do it already? Kind of appeal there? Or is that overthinking a middle of the night ramble?
You know, I don't know if it's as much targeting Manchin as much as it might be trying to remind Republicans and, you know, anyone who might have been tuning in at that hour. Republicans are very good at, you know, kind of just clinching on something very simple to kind of make a bigger point. And him, of course, saying that is saying like, wow, you're going to be living, you're going to be much colder because, you know, they're going to try and turn off or tell you that you can't use your heater. And it kind of goes back to that whole Republican talking point of Democrats are trying to control every single aspect of your life. Soon they're going to be coming after your heater. Soon you can't even control the temperature within your own home. And, you know, McCarthy made that point in several ways. There was one point, of course, Democrats were jeering and laughing at him at some points in the earlier hours of this speech. And at one point, one Democratic member, I couldn't see who it was from my vantage point, but said, you should be looking at the speaker. You should be looking at the Democrat who was presiding over the floor instead of looking over at Democrats. And then he, McCarthy, took that point throughout the night to just say, and now I can't even believe Democrats are trying to control even where my eyeballs are. They're trying to control where I'm looking, who I should listen to. And that really just delves back into that point that really has resonated among the Republican base, which is Democrats are trying to control every single inch of you and your life and your family.
So did we just hear the 2022 congressional midterm campaigns in a nutshell there from McCarthy and Jen Psaki? Assuming for the moment that some version of Build Back Better gets passed, is it going to be socialism on the march versus you don't even care about your own constituents' families?
Yeah, you know, when you talk to House Democrats, especially those who represent those very swing districts, they say the biggest thing that they're going to be talking about on the campaign trail is how the Build Back Better Act is going to help families, how it is just going to alleviate multiple things in your life. You no longer have to stress about, you know, where you can put your 4-year-old, your 3-year-old, if you have to go to work, because it's going to be universal pre-K. They're going to be talking about the child tax credit, how you're getting, how families are getting extra money in their bank account that can go towards, you know, paying for diapers, paying for whatever they may need. So that is really how Democrats are going to be framing it. Of course, there's so much more in this $1.7 trillion bill. But the biggest takeaway for many people is that part, talking about how it's going to make your life easier, especially for your family. Healthcare is another component, because that, of course, was a winning message in 2018, where you saw a number of these, as we call them, frontline vulnerable Democrats be you know, coming in with that blue wave into the House. And those are the seats they're trying to protect. So that's going to be the main message. While Republicans, of course, they were successful with that socialist message in 2020. So they're going to be talking about government overreach, government takeover, and you're not going to have any decisions in your life.
Listeners, your call is welcome here on the Build Back Better bill, or human infrastructure bill, as Biden sometimes calls it, having passed the House and officially now in the lap of the Senate, or anything related, for Washington Post congressional correspondent Mariana Sotomayor. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Follow us on Twitter. I'll watch your tweets go by if you tag us. On the point you were just making, since the main child care and elder care provisions of this poll so well and might seem like mom and apple pie to many people, and with the tax hikes on the top few percent and corporations that make it almost a deficit neutral bill, do you get the sense that the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee would really be running against it if it passes as a red menace, or just trying to change the subject next year?
Well, they're definitely going to be campaigning against the Build Back Better. You know, this is a two-part bill, and this is two parts of what Biden has wanted: the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is now law, and the Build Back Better Act. And they're not really going against the infrastructure bill. And, you know, when you actually talk to those reelection campaign groups, they don't want to necessarily shine a spotlight on the fact that many Republicans, both in the Senate, less in the House, but they were still there, 13 of them, voted with Democrats to, as they have been talking, as a lot of the more Trump allies in the House have been saying, to, you know, kind of give Biden a win. They are very much trying to make sure that Republicans don't align with Biden in any way, in any bipartisan shape or form. So you won't be hearing too much about them griping against the infrastructure bill, but that's exactly why they're really going to hold on to the Build Back Better Act, that social spending plan, as the hardest thing they're going to hit on the campaign trail. And the way that they're basically framing it is, look at the world we live in right now. There's inflation. People have sticker shock at the grocery store. They're looking at their gas bill and that number continuing to go up at the gas pump. How can Democrats even think about adding $1.7 trillion that's going to come out, maybe not in your taxes, but it'll come out in this way through, you know, higher inflation, all of which is not the case. Because as you mentioned, this bill, Democrats, especially moderates who knew they were going to get attacked on the campaign trail, knew that they had to push to make sure it was deficit neutral, make sure it was all paid for. And now that some of that is going to be massaged out a little bit more in the Senate to make sure that that is the case, because of course this bill will undergo some changes there. But Republicans are really going to try and attack it through this more blanket way, kind of reminding them this is big government, it's going to hurt you. And some voters are already resonating with that point of view, especially now with this kind of uncertain economy.
And I guess the Republicans are going to find some line or two in the bill that looks like an outrage of government control over some thing or another, and try to focus on that rather than that it has universal child care, universal pre-K, more home health aides for the infirm elderly, and those other things that a lot of people will perceive as benefits. Did you hear the moment in the McCarthy speech when he said, nobody elected Joe Biden to be FDR, and AOC shot back, I did.
Yep. Yes. And there was another member who said, me too.
missed that. I wonder if that also breaks out next year then, like pro or anti-Biden as FDR, pro or anti-FDR as relevant to today's economy and today's middle-class struggles, you know, whether that's what a chronically middle-class challenged America wants. You think FDR is going to be a factor in next year's race if Build Back Better passes?
Yeah, well, maybe FDR symbolizing, you know, the big reforms that are to come. And, you know, one thing that Democrats are very much cognizant of is the fact that some of these provisions, even if this is signed into law next month or early January, I know Congress is really pushing for this becoming law in December, a lot of these provisions aren't actually going to be installed or felt yet by the American public for some time. And that is a concern for some of these more vulnerable Democrats, of course, in swing districts, because they don't want to overpromise, right? They can start selling what's in the bill. They can start saying, this is what you're going to get. But, you know, talking to a number of those members, they say we have to be realistic too, because there could be potentially backlash if you're telling them you're going to get this, you're going to get hearing benefits from Medicare, you're going to get all these number of things. But if voters don't feel that necessarily, they could blame Democrats for lying or not working fast enough for them to be able to receive those things, even though it's coming. So you could get that is a potential issue some Democrats are talking about, and, you know, how to strategize and campaign in an effective way so that, you know, this big government approach that some people may already be talking about, they don't say, oh my gosh, all this money was allotted to something, but we as voters aren't feeling it. Did that money go?
Is Obamacare an example from recent history of what you were just saying? I have a tweet from a listener that says, please ask. It says, is GOP freaking out about Build Back Better based on how America has embraced Obamacare? But if we remember 2010, Obama's first midterm elections, the Democrats lost control of Congress just after Obamacare passed. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that by the time the end of this past decade came about, Republicans were shrinking from repeal and replace because Obamacare had become pretty popular. Would you look at it that way? And is that a timeline that concerns the Democrats or encourages the Democrats and the Republicans, vice versa?
Yeah, you know, it depends on who you ask on the Democratic side. Everyone is in agreement that, yes, in a couple congressional midterms from now, it'll likely play out in a similar way, where all of these benefits will be felt. And, you know, if Republicans go on a repeal and replace type of message, well, a lot of voters who are now feeling those benefits may not want any of those repeals to happen. So Republicans do feel confident that they're going to win messaging in the short term. So just right now, leading up to 2022, if the economy, again, if we're still dealing with inflation and a lot of these benefits aren't being felt, Republicans do see an advantage there. And Democrats recognize that they might have that. But that's why Democrats also on the campaign trail really need to hammer, and they know that they haven't done this well so far. They do acknowledge that they need to tell voters, we Democrats are the ones who are giving you this. Don't forget that we are the ones several years from now, when you see those changes, when you see these new bridges, when you see all of this now affecting your life, that was Democrats. Democrats did that solely. So in some ways, they're also preparing for the next couple of elections, where at some point you might see that mirror of 2018, where healthcare, Obamacare, really became the message for Democrats in the midterms that helped them win. Republicans are going to take that away if you elect them. This is a Democratic signature bill, so keep us there because we can legislate.
Listener Judy tweets, is there any irony in the fact that the Republicans are passing laws that restrict a woman's right to choose? That is actual big government. When we come back, we haven't even gotten yet to the Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema politics of this and how that may or may not have changed now that the House has actually passed the bill. We'll continue with Mariano Sotomayor and take your phone calls and more tweets as well. 212-433 WNYC, Mariana Washington Post congressional correspondent. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Washington Post congressional correspondent Mariana Sotomayor as we talk about this moment when the Build Back Better Human Infrastructure Bill has actually passed the House and now gone to the Senate, where it's going to land even more squarely in Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema's laps, since we can assume no Republican yes vote. We can't assume no Republican yes votes, right? I mean, 13 voted for physical infrastructure in the House.
Yeah, this is going to be just Democrats only, and they've known that since the beginning on this human infrastructure bill.
And before we leave Kevin McCarthy entirely and that all-nighter on the House floor, he also referred during his speech to getting a call from Donald Trump. And it's easy to forget that back on January 6th, McCarthy held Trump explicitly responsible in a speech from the House floor for the insurrection that threatened the lives of he and his colleagues in the Capitol. How far has he come from that position?
Well, you've definitely seen a change. He was very critical of Trump and Trump supporters the evening of January 6th. But, you know, he really wants to be Speaker of the House if Republicans are able to win the majority during the next midterms. And in order to get there, you have to win that very Trump loyalist base. Of course, that's Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, and, you know, Matt Gaetz of Florida, a number of them. It's a small group, but they could potentially grow, especially now that we're seeing a lot of redistricting, much more partisan districts, and many Republican candidates running on that Trump America First message. And so he knows he needs those people in order to be speaker. And, you know, last week, in light of all of these different things happening within the Republican conference, my colleagues and I were asking those members specifically, would you vote for Kevin McCarthy for speaker? And Marjorie Taylor Greene was one of the first ones to say that she didn't know yet. They didn't want to answer that question. And for her, it was, well, I'm not seeing a lot of leadership yet. Many the leaders aren't necessarily defending people like me. And, you know, we're the ones who really resonate with the American public, with the Republican base. So that has been a big motivator for him to not necessarily punish, Congressman Paul Gosar or even Green for repeated outlandish remarks, or in Gosar's case, that violent video. That's why you've seen him be more cautious. And you've also seen it on his staff side. They have also been more cautious in talking to reporters. In previous years, they were definitely a little bit more open. And it's all because they have an eye on that singular mission, which is for him to become the Speaker of the House.
That Gosar snuff video, I've seen it called, in which an animated version of himself literally murders AOC and is going next after Biden. And yet I hear talk that if the Republicans do take the House next year, McCarthy can expect a serious challenge from some of those most right-wing members, like Jim Jordan. I've heard that name. People know who he is from the impeachment hearings, if nothing else, or Steve Scalise. How do you assess the politics of that potential scenario?
Yeah, you know, Kevin McCarthy, of course, wanted to be speaker several years ago. This is before Paul Ryan became speaker. And the number one person to say that McCarthy wasn't ready, that he's not good enough to lead the caucus, was Jim Jordan. Since that time, McCarthy has been working that relationship with Jordan, and they're actually very close friends now, to the point where no one sees Jordan as a credible threat to McCarthy. They don't think that he actually will, try and, try and just make sure that he's no longer in the run for the speakership. But that threat, of course, does now come from that very pro-Trump base. You know, no one has thrown their name out there. No one has said, I'm going to run or challenge him. We are still some time away from that, and they know that. But that is likely where you could potentially see any kind of challenge. But something else, which is kind of a surprise, but as we know, anything can happen in politics. A lot of that pro-Trump base has actually been saying, hey, why Why don't we elect Trump to be Speaker of the House? That has been a small cry, but it's kind of growing. And fun fact, literally any American citizen can become Speaker of the House if they have the vote. So that would be a whole different thing to cover. We're kind of a ways away from that news cycle, but it is a growing want for this pro-Trump caucus.
Do you take that seriously? Because we've talked about it on the show before with another reporter, but it was a few months ago, who took it as just talk, that since any person, whether or not they're in the House of Representatives, can be named Speaker by the majority, that they would actually elect Donald Trump Speaker of the House if they win the House next year? How seriously do you take that?
As of right now, it is just talk. But, you know, if you can even imagine a scenario, then there could be a possibility of that. If you do get more of these pro-Trump candidates who just want Trump as their leader, whether it's in the House or whether it is as another presidential candidate, could that cry grow louder? Sure. I don't know if we're at the point yet to be able to say whether, you know, this is actually going to play out. But as we've learned with Trump's own candidacy and him becoming president, if you don't take some of these things seriously or don't keep an eye on them, things may surprise you.
How much power would he have as Speaker of the House, but not a member of Congress?
It really would depend on his own conference, which, of course, they would have named him to be a speaker. So he would have that influence. You know, what it would be like to work across the aisle, that likely
wouldn't happen. Is it deciding who goes on what committees? Is it deciding what bills come to the floor? What actual power would he have, if you know?
Yeah, committee assignments is big. You know, the leader himself is part of the gang of eight, or sometimes the gang of four, besides the top leader. So you would get all of the top intelligence briefings on an array of issues. You're usually one of the first people briefed besides the president on other issues that doesn't have to deal with intelligence. So you are actively in a place where you can make those decisions. But of course, the bills that come to the floor, potentially removing Democrats from their own committees, those are some of the positions of power that a speaker definitely has.
Mariana Sotomayor with us, Washington Post congressional correspondent, who should get, I don't know if the Post has some kind of award for pulling an all-nighter to hear Kevin McCarthy on the House floor give an eight-hour filibuster speech before the Build Back Better human infrastructure vote. But listeners, she did it. She stayed up all night, watched the whole thing, reported on the whole thing. She was assigned. I'm assuming you were assigned. This is not necessarily the first choice of how you, but there you go. In case you didn't know the context, this is a badge that she now gets to wear at the Washington Post offices. We're going to make the turn to Manchin and Sinema now through Vicky in Tudor City. Vicky, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for such a great discussion. I caught the wind of McCarthy's sort of fear-mongering that all of this expense is going to come from the taxpayer and the middle class and the lower middle class. But wasn't it Kyrsten Sinema who really balked about any of these monies coming from taxes for businesses that are earning in the millions and the 1% and 2% who are not sufficiently taxed?
Yes, that is correct. It was interesting to actually see Joe Manchin. He was really big on, you know, initially when he was saying, these are the things I want, he wanted a full repeal of the Trump tax law. He said that was botchily made, quickly made. It was not good legislation. And you actually saw Sinema, who has definitely, you know, shown her own wish list to the White House. She's been more quiet than Manchin. She said that she didn't want to see businesses taxed to a higher rate. She didn't want to go back to those Trump or pre-Trump era taxes for, you know, corporations, for big businesses. So it definitely was a challenge for Democrats who all essentially were united in raising taxes for the billionaires, the very wealthy, and the corporations. And she was the one that kind of forced Democrats to try and find a different way to do that.
And I guess we should say, though, on that point, that the real math, and I think I've talked about this before, not only the media, but I think the Democrats themselves frequently fail to articulate the actual spending that would be involved in this bill, even before we get to how much it's paid for by those tax increases. People keep saying the $1.75 trillion bill, that's over 10 years. So each year it's only, and we can't say only in the context of the size of the federal government annual budget, $175 billion, because that's a 10-year bill. The military gets, what, $800 billion every year? And this to add universal pre-K, other child care, elder care, the other things in the bill. So I don't know that they messaged that very well in terms of putting the right number on it. But does this passage in the House, the actual passage in the House, change anything for Sinema and Manchin in terms of the politics?
Well, we might see a more outspoken Sinema. She has privately told House members for a while, and recently in an interview with the Washington Post, that she didn't want to necessarily say more than she needed to while the House was doing their considerations. It was kind of a respect for let the House kind of figure it out, even though the House, of course, was definitely wanting the input of Manchin and Sinema so that they could send a bill over that wasn't going to change too much. There are some things that we already know are likely to change. The paid family leave, Manchin is firmly opposed to that. Of course, senators and members will still try and work him on that. Sinema is actually someone who does want to see that provision stay, but that could likely be stripped out to make sure that you do get Manchin's vote for the rest of it. A lot of it is in the Senate parliamentarians' hands, just to see what matches up to the budgetary rules to make sure that this could pass in this, what we call a vehicle known as reconciliation, which will only allow for Democratic votes to pass this. And one of the things that are likely going to be, that likely going to fall out because of that parliamentarian scrub, is immigration. That is $110 billion that's going to be allotted to work permits, which would essentially allow undocumented immigrants. It does not give them a pathway to citizenship, but it also prevents them from deportation, and it gives them the ability to work and potentially travel home. That is likely going to be taken out. And that is probably the biggest issue that could affect how this passes in the House, because of course a changed bill is going to go back to the House. There are three Democrats, Hispanic members, who say that they can't vote for this bill if it doesn't address immigration in some form. So that is definitely something that we will keep an eye on.
So there's negotiation yet to come, obviously. Hey, before you go, Mariana, our next segment is going to be about the larger implications of the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. And I see that Congressman Matt Gaetz has said he wants to offer Rittenhouse an internship. And Paul Gosar, who we just talked about, fresh from his snuff film animation showing him murdering AOC and going for Biden next, Gosar tweeted out a poll to his followers, I see, asking if Rittenhouse should get a Congressional Medal of Honor. And, of course, that goes beyond agreeing that he was acting in self-defense in a tough situation to implying support for more armed white vigilantism as a concept. Is Leader McCarthy or anyone else questioning that?
Well, I don't think that McCarthy would go as far to give Rittenhouse a Medal of Honor. Might be different if Trump were Speaker, but you have seen this kind of emergence of different Republican members in the House kind of jockeying to see who can get Rittenhouse as an intern. Like you mentioned a couple names there. I'm not fully sure if leadership can prevent a staffer from serving in someone's office. I don't know exactly how that works. It might have to go through like ethics committee to really make sure someone is removed. But if such an internship were to be offered and he accepts, there could be the scenario where he could be a House intern.
Mariana Sotomayor covers Congress, especially the House leadership of both parties, for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.